Financial technology, or fintech, is one of the fastest growing industries in the world today, with New York, London, Tel Aviv, Edinburgh, Singapore, Moscow, and other major cities all vying for a piece of the action. Welcome to Breaking Banks, the first dedicated radio show that focuses on how this new boom is changing everything, from the way we bank to the very concept of money itself. Now, here's your host, Brett King.
Welcome to Breaking Banks. We're live from sunny New York today. It's the weather's glorious. Actually, it's a bit warm, but that's good. All good. I don't know whether you guys have seen that there's the news is hotting up about the iPhone. We're going to be talking about that in a moment and the iWatch. Interesting, a couple of pieces today. Saw a piece from in Forbes. From one of the bloggers we like to follow, Tom Groenfeld. He's a contributor on Forbes. Really interesting article on fintech startup labs from London to Hong Kong is the topic of the article. Definitely should check it out. There's obviously this is the year. 2014 is the year where fintech has hit the map. I think we can announce that. It's everyone's talking about it right now, and this is the place where all the rumors and everything that's happening in fintech. We are fintech central here on Breaking Banks. So stay with us today. We've got a fantastic show for you. We're going to be talking to Chris Withers in a moment, who's with the IBM Watson team. And we have James Barrett coming on. He's a documentary filmmaker who wrote a book called The Final Invention about machine intelligence, artificial intelligence. He is up later in the show as well. But before we get to that, let's cross to some of you will know Ian. Ian is with Bank Innovation, Royal Media. Ian Carr, welcome to Breaking Banks.
Hey, Brett. Thanks. I'm very excited to be here for my first time.
So, you know, we were talking earlier today, you know, you called me up and we were chatting about the iPhone, iWatch, iWallet rumors. And you seem to have a really good grasp on this because you've been spending the last few days pretty much embedded in all these, in the rumor mill. So tell us, what's the latest on this? So we're just days away now, but where are we stacking up on the rumors?
Yeah, so I've been able to confirm some stuff. Some other rumors that I've been hearing have been are a little I haven't been able to, you know, confirm yet, but so here's what we know. So deals are in place with Visa, MasterCard, and Amex for sure. Recode and Bloomberg have reported this as well earlier. And also, Apple seems to have made deals with the issuers, as in banks like J.P. Morgan, Chase, and other banks as well. So
probably Wells.
Yeah, probably Wells. I mean, we know for sure J.P. Morgan, Bank of America, Chase.
Yep.
But here's the thing: Apple needs the networks who are Visa, MasterCard, and American Express. Now they don't necessarily need the banks on board, but for Apple's purposes, they actually did. The thing is, Apple really wanted a card present rate, which means that the the card was actually in the transaction. And the only way, and that's mandated by the issuers. So the issuers usually determine whether a transaction is card present or card not present. You know, card not present is Square transactions where, you know, they charge 2.75% on the fee. So according to my sources, Apple offered to handle the security and assume the liability on a lot of the risk with by using their biometrics and NFC location data. So Apple,
and you know, this is actually pretty interesting because you know, once widespread mobile use is in place, this whole card present, card not present, we're going to have to rethink about this. There's going to be a third category, which is card not present but phone present and authenticated.
Yeah. So Dave Birch has talked a little bit about this on Twitter. He refers to it as a cardholder present rate. So the cardholder is there,
yes.
But yeah, it's very interesting. I think there needs to be some sort of third rate system for these mobile wallets. But that's, you know, down the line, I think.
Now, what about the ecosystem in terms of what Apple's trying to achieve, apart from the payment itself? How are they differentiating? How are they, you know, particularly in the in-store experience?
The in-store experience. So they'll be using NFC. It's tough to say. So earlier this week, we wrote that Nordstrom is in talks to be an early merchant partner. Seems like that's being solidified as well. And
you actually went down to the Nordstrom. Can we talk about this?
So we saw we verified visually that the mobile POS terminals that were used in Nordstrom's were the same ones as that they use in the Apple stores. So what that means, that's actually a very interesting implication. So when I asked employees about this, they said that they purchased them directly from Apple. I wrote this in the article. So it's interesting that they purchased these terminals directly from Apple. When I contacted Nordstrom for a comment, they declined to comment on who their supplier. The in-store experience is still murky, but we should expect some merchants like Nordstrom's. I've heard a lot of rumors about merchants.
It appears that they're definitely going to be using both the BLE and NFC component. There's obviously an iTouch biometric play to this, otherwise they wouldn't be so prepared to take the risk on the transaction, so there's a security element. But it'd be interesting to see whether or not the BLE play is a merchant play with their POS infrastructure or something like that. Maybe they're thinking more about the loyalty side.
Yeah, I know. I have been hearing that there are very, very early rumors, very, very recent, that there's a loyalty play about this whole thing. I'm still working, still digging a little bit, but there are rumors about loyalty
out there as well.
Attachment to the iWallet.
So the iWallet, we've got confirmation now that it's in both the phone and the iWatch, which we're not sure what it's going to be called yet, the iWatch, but...
The name of the watch is still very, very up in the air. I wouldn't go so far to say confirmation, but I would say it's safe to assume that both the NFC, the iWatch and the iPhone 6 will have an NFC chip and... Based on my sources, it'll be supplied. I don't know whether it's 100% supplied, but at least NXP, which is a famous NFC chip supplier, will be supplying Apple with the chips.
Fantastic. Well, Ian, look, that's a great roundup. Thanks for stopping by Breaking Banks. We've got a maybe we might get you to jump in. We're going to sort of a Gilmore Gang Google Hangout we're trying to put together with Jim Morales and Brad Limer and a few others for the launch on the 9th. So maybe you should join us on that as well as the news breaks.
Yes, absolutely. I would be more than happy to.
Fantastic. That's Ian Carr from you're welcome. Thanks. It's Ian Carr from Bank Innovation, Rural Media. You can check out bankinnovation.net for more information as the rumors break. Okay, so at the back of all of this, part of Apple's strategy is undoubtedly going to be trying to think about behavior in-store, capturing more of the payments ecosystem and understanding how people behave. And, there's a lot of work being done on data analytics and understanding behavior and understanding patterns in this. And one of the really breakout technologies in respect to this is the work that's been done at IBM on Watson. So right now, it'd be great to introduce Chris Withers to the show. Chris, welcome
Thanks,
to Breaking
Brett.
Banks.
Thanks, Brett. Yeah, I'm excited to be on.
And I was very happy today to see the IBM Watson bot actually tweeting out about the show, as well as yourself. But give us a little bit of history about Watson and this emerging machine intelligence, because IBM's been working on this for years, if not decades. So tell us a little bit about how Watson came into being. Let's kick it off with that.
Yeah, it's a great story, actually. So about every decade, IBM does something what we call a grand challenge. So back in the 90s, we played Garry Kasparov at chess with our computer called Deep Blue and ended up beating him. And people saw that as quite a milestone. And people look around for these challenges, and the story goes that there were some researchers in a bar in New York, and suddenly it all went hushed, and they looked around to figure why, and people were watching TV because Ken Jennings, who had, I think, the longest streak on the game show Jeopardy, was playing, and he just won a game. And someone said, so, hey, why don't we see if we can build a computer that can play Jeopardy? Because certainly for your US listeners, I guess they'll be fairly familiar with it, but for me, based in the UK, I hadn't really heard too much about the program, but it's quite difficult. You know, the kind of questions that you know, we give as examples are, why Maltese borrows many words from Italian, it developed from a dialect of this Semitic language. You know, those are quite tough questions, and they can be on any subject. So I won't ask you, Brett, what the answer to that one is, but it is Arabic.
I don't know.
I'm sure you knew that one. So the researchers persuaded the bosses to fund this investment. So back in 2006, we actually started building what became Watson. And it's very tough because it's open, what we call open domain. So the questions for Jeopardy can be on absolutely everything, absolutely anything. And really, to play the game, you've got to understand the questions. So you've got to understand in the way that question was asked, you know, what kind of answer are you looking for? And then search a knowledge base and come back with it. So the researchers sort of spent 5 years doing that. And then in February 2011, we were ready to play the game show. And we played Brad Rutter and Ken Jennings, who were the two guys who'd won the most money and had the longest winning streaks. And Watson won.
He whooped them, actually, didn't he?
He did. You know, and see some great clips, actually, of Brad and Ken as they look at the screen and look at Watson and thinking, how did it know that? So, you know, it's a good clips to look at on YouTube. It's really quite amazing, actually. So that was a huge step forward. And the technology that sort of underlies that is natural language processing, which, you know, has been around for a while, but certainly IBM's one of the companies who've had that technology, because you've got to understand the question as it was in Jeopardy, and sort of, as we talk about moving it forward, understand the way that we speak and what are the meaning of the words and the way that you and I would speak now and put them together. So you've got to understand that. Then the second sort of technology that Watson brought together was sort of hypothesis generation. So this is where it works a little bit differently to humans. So it understands the question, and then it generates as many hypotheses of what that possible answer could be as possible, and then searches its knowledge base. So for us, we're searching our brains, but for Watson, for Jeopardy, it was searching Wikipedia. We just sort of loaded Wikipedia in, as well as texts and novels and so on. So it would search through its knowledge base and say, for this candidate answer, can I find any evidence that backs it up? And it would give precedence and a more weighting to texts where it had found the information before and texts that were reliable, and then bring back that answer. So if you have a look at the clips for that game show, it shows Watson's top three answers and how confident it was. And so Watson would buzz in when it was really confident about the answer. And if it wasn't confident, then it wouldn't buzz in. And it, you know, because if you buzz it in Jeopardy and get the question wrong, you actually lose some money. And we couldn't train it to answer every question. So it had to be able to learn automatically. Yeah, so it had to learn. So it had to learn. We'd give it questions, and it would learn, and we'd say, good, Watson, that's correct answer, and you got it right for the right reason, and no, that's the wrong answer, and this is where that answer came from. So over time, that sort of machine learning that's really, you know, so important and so of the moment was absolutely crucial to it, because we couldn't teach it on every possible combination of question that Jeopardy might come up with. It was just, you know, it's almost an infinite number.
Fascinating. I'm trying to remember when this was, but it was back in the, it must have been the very late 80s or early 90s. I was at a conference, and Bill Gates was talking at this conference, and we were talking, there was someone from MIT there, and we were talking about natural language processing. And I remember at the time that the researchers were saying, we don't know if we're ever going to be able to crack this. Right, must have been late 80s. We're not sure we're ever going to be able to crack this. We may not ever be able to get a machine to understand human language. Well, of course, we now have Siri and all of these technologies. There's been huge breakthroughs in this. So the natural language processing is sort of a breakthrough that has happened on many fronts. But the machine learning thing. this is something that only really we're able to get into with the types of constructs like Watson available, because you can theorize on it, but until you actually are interacting with the machine that's learning, then you can't really talk about it with confidence, right?
Yeah, that's right. And it's interesting the way that we train Watson. It's not like a typical computer program. It's very different to, say, business rules or a decision tree. You know, when we're training Watson for, you know, commercial client, we give it questions, you know, the kind of questions that they might be asked through their call center. So often they have training manuals, you know, particularly in financial services. And then Watson's got a body of knowledge, and it comes back with the answer, and it's trained to by saying, yes, that's right, or no, that's wrong. And the reason you do that is not so you go through every possible question that a customer might ask through the call center. It's so that it starts to learn, and it's really those power of those machine learning algorithms that allows you actually to release something that, like, that is accurate enough.
Almost creating intuition.
Yeah.
It's fascinating. Yep. Those algorithms that allow Watson to learn, what's been invested in creating that part of the platform in terms of time and effort?
Yeah, so, I mean, that's really all the way through from 2006 up to where we are now. So after we played Jeopardy, the first sort of applications that we applied outside of game shows, because it was kind of decommissioned for game shows at that point, was in cancer. So, and that's quite an interesting area because for Watson, because there's so much research produced, you know, all the research papers, all the clinical trials, that even if a doctor read 24/7, they couldn't possibly keep up with it. So although the sort of practice of medicine hasn't changed much, you know, obviously the equipment has, but not the practice so much, it was really interesting that we applied it to cancer in partnership with, you know, some of the big cancer hospitals in the U.S., like Memorial Sloan Kettering, MD Anderson, and Cleveland Clinic, and they're using it in a variety of different ways. But one of them is with Memorial Sloan Kettering, where we're developing a sort of oncology advisor where a patient will have their symptoms, and Watson will try and figure out the diagnosis for that based on those symptoms, and it's there to provide sort of decision support to the doctor, and it helps them obviously be more effective because it can analyze a patient's conditions and their diagnosis and symptoms before the consult, and then during the consult the doctor's that much more up to speed. And again, a bit like Jeopardy, it gives a confidence weighted scoring of what it thinks of the diagnosis is. So the more confident it is, obviously that's good, but you always have the doctor there to intervene, and if Watson's not confident, then they can go in and look at stuff themselves.
But obviously,
we did that really post Jeopardy through to the end of 2013, and then we formed the Watson Group, formerly in IBM, at the start of 2014, and it's a $1 billion investment for us, and we commercialized it across many sectors now, including sort of financial services.
Yes, well, we'll talk about that in a moment. Very, very interesting, fascinating stuff. Let's take a quick break, Chris, and then after the break, we can come back and hear more about specifically what you're doing in financial services. Okay? You're listening to the story of IBM Watson's creation. You're on Breaking Banks. I'm your host, Brett King. We'll be right back after this short break. I use my mobile phone constantly, and as a result, you know, my mobile bill is pretty heavy each month. One of the problems with using the big wireless providers in 2019 is you're paying for a lot of that infrastructure they have. They're expensive, you know, glossy retail stores, the big prices, the hidden fees. But we don't often feel like we have a choice. That's where Mint Mobile comes in. Mint Mobile provides the same type of premium network coverage you're used to with the big guys, but at a fraction of the cost because they do everything online. Mint Mobile saves on retail locations, overheads, and they pass those savings directly on to the consumer. Now, what makes Mint Mobile great is it cuts your wireless bill down to just $15 a month. Every plan comes with unlimited nationwide text and talk, and you can pay for exactly the data you want. So you don't pay for having too big a data package. You can choose between plans with 3, 8, 12 gigabytes of 4G LTE data.
and you can keep your own phone, you can keep your same phone number, and of course all your existing contacts. So get your new wireless plan for just $15 a month and get the plan shipped directly to your door for free. Go to mintmobile.com/fintech. That's mintmobile.com/fintech. Cut your wireless bill down to just $15 a month today at mintmobile.com/fintech.
When it comes to business, you'll find the experts here. Voice America Business Network.
You're listening to Breaking Banks, featuring your host, Brett King. To reach the show today, please call 1-866-472-5790. That's 1-866-472-5790. Or join the conversation on Twitter by using the hashtag Breaking Banks. Now, back to the program.
Welcome back to Breaking Banks. I'm Brett King, your host. We've been talking, at the start of the show, we were talking about the iWallet rumors. That's heating up, 9th of September. Stand by, mobile payments are coming in a big way. But we've been talking before the break with Chris Withers, who's from the IBM Watson team. Now, Chris, very, very interesting, the whole machine learning and the natural language processing capability that you've built into Watson. But tell us specifically about what's happening in the financial services space. I know you mentioned the research into cancer and the diagnosis stuff, but you've been doing some work recently with DBS and USAA. Tell us about how Watson's being used there and how successful it's been.
Yeah. So just recently, USAA have gone live with a consumer-facing application which uses Watson. So, as you probably know, USAA serves the military community, and there's a lot of people who are transitioning from military to civilian life. So one of the first use cases that USAA have released and released, you know, through their USAA.site and mobile app is an advisor, really, which can give guidance to those vets who are transitioning. So the kind of question they might ask is, can I be in the reserves and still collect my veteran benefits? You know, there's a myriad of stuff around that. So what USAA and IBM together did was we ingested about 3,000 documents which detail all of the things that pertain to transitioning to civilian life, that could be where to live, all of those kinds of information. So for such an important life event for those military vets, they've now got this kind of question and answer service provided by USAA, sort of powered by Watson, where they can ask any question. And they're really interesting dialogues people will have with it. And if Watson doesn't know the question, it'll ask someone to rephrase it. But you find that the vets using it have a really good, strong interaction with it. So I think we're both really pleased with it. So that's the first consumer-facing one. So we also worked with DBS in Singapore, and that's at the other end of the spectrum. Really. They're serving high net worth individuals. So this is where they're using Watson to help their relationship managers analyze the masses of documents that come out from the investment office, such, you know, research reports and so on, product information about the products and services that they offer, as well as analyze customer profiles. And what Watson's doing there is analyzing those and then using that to help arm the relationship managers with advice on what they should be, when they speak to their clients.
And I think giving the advisors advice, don't you love that?
Exactly, because a bit like the cancer example, and often the oncology advisor is, you know, quite seen as a very similar analogy, particularly in wealth management. The interesting thing is Watson gives you the evidence behind the answer. So for quite a lot of deterministic systems, which are business rules, you'll get an answer popped out. But when Watson gives an answer, it also gives the evidence behind it. So that's, I think, really interesting for use cases, you know, right the way along from USAA through up to, you know, high net worth clients at DBS, because people are interested in the rationale behind things, and that's what Watson's doing. Because when it's found an answer, it's found it because it's looked through documents and it's scored that information. So it thinks this, and it thinks this for this reason. So it gives that the consumers and the relationship managers that extra piece of information as to why they think that's a good piece of guidance or recommendation.
Great. So if you're listening into the show, don't forget you can tweet us with a question. Just use the hashtag BreakingBanks, or you can tweet me directly at Brett King. If you've got a question for Chris or any of the guests at any time, just be sure to ping us on live, and we'll try and answer best we can. So Chris, there's an interesting element here. We saw recent news, and I'm a little skeptical about this, but there was a I think it was MIT or one of these guys had an algorithm that had passed the Turing test for the first time. And there's an element of this where once we get these machines learning or to a sufficient capability in terms of the ability to absorb information, process it, and put it back as advice, that advice can really compete in terms of the value of it compared with the advice you'd get from a human advisor. Is this really where I think, are we starting to see constructs like Watson being used to help us get smarter, to augment our decision-making process? Is that a large portion of where your investment is going into this interface?
So I think the use cases that we see, so USAA is a good example of where and they've trained Watson, but it was their people and their expert advisors really who trained it, such that their customers can come on and ask questions directly of Watson. So in that case, they're answering the questions directly to a machine and it's coming back with the answers. But as the information changes or some new information comes in, you still need the advisors, the human advisors, to interpret that and to train Watson. What Watson really gives USAA in that respect is, it's a very... it's accessible in the way that digital is, so it's accessible 24/7. Watson doesn't go to sleep. And I think the other thing we find is people are much more willing to ask what they consider sort of stupid questions to machines rather than to humans. So they do, there's that element of not feeling that you're being judged when you speak to a machine. But also it's very scalable, so you can scale it out at very low marginal cost compared to advice in a different way. But just as in DBS, I think there will, and the same for oncology as well, Watson is really in that respect providing augmentation and decision support for those sort of professions where there's just an information overload. So it's just impossible for those doctors to read everything that's going on, and the same with the relationship managers with all the investment advice and financial news that's out there. So I think we see these cases across the spectrum.
So, right now you're working on this, you said across the spectrum, but I find it really interesting that as the machine learns and as the quality of the answers get better, then, you're not really going to be able to beat the advice that Watson could give you in a particular setting, particularly for, like in the Pareto principle, the 80-20 rule. 80% of the time, it's probably going to get better advice. One of the problems you have with wealth managers, for example, is you take a wealth manager at HSBC, they got 50,000 potential products that they can recommend across the, all the different asset classes. They can't possibly know even 1% of that product base. But Watson could. So this is finding that right product. We've always, I think, had a romantic view about this as bankers, that an advisor in a bank will be able to give you the right advice. But with this sort of capability, I would question whether an advisor could really compete with something like Watson once it's up to speed in terms of the quality of matching the right product to you at the right time. Very interesting.
I think it is really interesting. And I think there's that aspect of, of the way that Watson's being used today at USAA and DBS. But I think the other interesting area that we see is radically kind of changing the user experience. So at USAA, obviously, people are asking questions of it. But we also see in that same way that this kind of idea of the financial concierge, where instead of the way that we have to interact with most sort of digital across any industry now is filling out forms, clicking search, interpreting the answers. The ability to actually speak to a computer in the way that we're speaking now in natural language and get it to execute things for you. So perhaps in the PFM space, you might want to say, show me the receipt for the washing machine I bought at Best Buy last year. you know, and the machine intelligence there would say, look back through and say, well, you didn't buy a washing machine from Best Buy, but you did buy a tumble dryer from Walmart, and that's close enough, and maybe that's what you mean. Or if you're offered a product, say an insurance product, before you buy it, you might want to know, does it cover me for skiing, if it's a, you know, travel insurance policy. So that ability to kind of interact with, in the way that you speak things and get actually actions kicked off, which could be, you know, add my partner to my insurance policy. That's, I think, another interesting area that we see. So that ability to use natural language, that ability to use that machine learning to actually kick off your business processes, really, that you have in your everyday sort of financial life, and provide that sort of financial virtual assistant or concierge.
So we had a question from Peter Olnick. Peter is in Charlotte, and he works for Carlisle and Gallagher. And he asked, does this place most current banking jobs at risk? But I think what you're saying is that still for the medium term, there is still synergy in, someone helping Watson learn, and B, working with this side by side.
Yeah, I think we will find that smart machines like Watson will be there to support us. I mean, as you know, across the ages, there's always been sort of concerns about machines taking over sort of our jobs, from the loom right the way through to the combustion engine. And, you know, our view is very much that really what we've got out there at the moment is this massive big data. It's, you know, our chief exec calls it the great new natural resource. There's just so much of it. And from that data, you can create incredible value. And we've seen that through some of the businesses, both in fintech, but also in other sectors that use this data that's out there. And I think our view would be very much that there's so much data out there that you can't process it as a human, but actually machines like Watson will help you do that. And through that, they'll create new jobs and different jobs, but they'll be leveraging this big data that's out there.
Yeah, absolutely. So in terms of what's next for Watson, where do you see this going over the next couple of years?
Yep, so I think some of the things that, you know, we talked about around making it accessible through mobile devices and providing that evidence base. You know, just recently we actually announced a new product where, rather than there being a right answer in the data that Watson ingests, and something called a discovery advisor, which is going to initially again be used in life sciences, but to help sort of accelerate the pace of scientific breakthroughs. So the example that we gave was we worked with Baylor College of Medicine and analyzed 70,000 documents around a specific protein that causes cancer. And I think over the last 20 years or so, the average protein that someone's discovered that might actually affect this, there might be a solution for this type of cancer, has been one a year. But Watson ingesting this found 6 potential proteins to be investigated. Wow. Again, using in life sciences, and what Watson's doing there is understanding, if you like, the language of science. But you can see how that could be applicable in financial analysis, in fraud and AML and so on. So we certainly see, you know, Watson advancing in that way and actually being used in more of those research areas.
Extremely efficient decision-making processes, particularly when it involves crunching data to come up with a conclusion.
Yeah, and it's, again, it's, I guess at the root of all this is there's just so much digital data out there now. The content that we produce, but also that shadow data from all of the information, or, you know, from our digital lives of where we are, mobile data and so on. So, again, it's, wherever there's a kind of information overload, there's probably a role for a machine like Watson to actually help and support the human in whatever role that they're doing, as well as create, you know, completely new businesses. So it's a fascinating time.
Great. All right. So let's see if we can introduce James into the session now. James, are you on?
I am.
Welcome to the show. James Barrett, the author of Final Invention, Our Final Invention.
Thanks very much for having me. It's great to be here,
good.
Brett.
Great. So why don't you just tell us a little bit about, you're a documentary filmmaker. How did you get into this area of artificial intelligence and machine intelligence?
Well, I did a film about artificial intelligence years ago, and I interviewed Ray Kurzweil, who's a great proponent of AI and a very kind of utopian view of the future, and I interviewed Rodney Brooks, who's just, you know, the sort of world's premier roboticist. Both of those guys were really optimistic about sharing the planet with smarter than human machines. But then I interviewed Arthur C. Clarke, who had been a scientist before he was a science fiction writer, and he was much more pessimistic, and that really got me thinking about some of the downsides of advanced artificial intelligence.
Well, you know, this is we see a lot of this fear-mongering that the machines are going to take over, the Terminator concept and things like that. But, you know, we don't really know what how machine intelligence are going to think, because by their nature already we're seeing things like Watson with its learning algorithms process information differently and think differently. So aren't we applying very human psychologies to this problem?
I think in the short term, the risk of advanced artificial intelligence in the short term, it's going to be in the hands of those who control it. In the long term, it's going to be whether or not we can control advanced artificial intelligence or not. I think right now we're seeing AI being used in very productive and interesting ways, like Watson. Although I do think we have to look closely at the disruption that's going to be caused by these machines and jobs. We have to look much more closely at that. But I think right now we can see advanced AI and data mining has been abused here in the United States by the NSA. You know, they siphoned off all that data. You know, we're talking about the ocean of data that we've got at our disposal now. Well, the NSA, the National Security Agency, was funneling off all our phone calls and our emails. And from that, they were getting my address book and probably yours. And in the process, stepping all over the Fourth Amendment, which prohibits illegal search and seizure without probable cause. So they were seizing that stuff illegally, but they could only do it because they were using advanced data mining software.
Right. So without some learning capability or the ability to suck in huge amounts of data and process it, then they wouldn't have had that capability.
I think exactly. And I think that it's about the challenge ahead of us now is who controls the AI. I think when you're using it for you know, right now I know Watson is taking the federal medical licensing exam so that it can become a medical diagnostician. I think that's terrific to assist with doctors, and it's going to be doing business analytics.
So Chris, I'll just ask Chris to jump in here. Chris, are we going to have to get Watson to sit the FINRA Series 66 or Series 6 exams or whatever they are soon?
That'd be fun, wouldn't it?
It would be. Sorry, James, this is, you know, so we were talking about the financial services impact before, but go ahead.
Sure. No, I think all that's very positive. I think, a report came out recently from MIT that 48% of jobs that exist right now are going to be displaced by automation and AI in the next 20 years.
Yeah.
So I think we have to, you know, this is a little bit different from the first machine age. You know, there's an excellent book I recommend to everybody besides my book, Our Final Invention, but it's called The Second Machine Age.
Right.
And it talks a lot about the
Luddites and, you know, these guys who are disrupted by early machine automation.
Right. Yes. I think that this, the information age is different really in kind than that. You know, steam power was, you know, its power and efficiency increased in a slow way. You know, I think it doubled every 70 years. Computer power doubles every 18 months, and it gets increases by a factor of 10 every 5 years. So it's a different, you know, I think
as long as Moore's law holds.
Yeah, well, with Google getting into quantum computing, I think Moore's law is going to be left in the dust pretty soon.
Absolutely.
So I think we have to keep an eye on that. We have to keep an eye on who's controlling the ways that we the ways that we use the data and manipulate the data, and how are we gathering the data.
Okay, very interesting. All right, so let's take a quick break, James. After we come back on the break, let's talk about how we think this might play out over the next 10 or 20 years.
Sure.
Okay, you're listening to Breaking Banks. I'm your host, Brett King. We have James Barrett, the author of Our Final Invention and a documentary filmmaker, and Chris Withers from the IBM Watson team talking artificial and machine intelligence. We'll be right back after this quick break.
These days in business, it's all about the metrics. If you don't know your numbers, you don't know your business. You don't have a business. But the problem growing businesses have that keeps them from knowing their numbers is just these disparate collection of business systems. You got one system for accounting, another for sales, another for inventory. It's just a big mess, you know. So taking too much time, too much resources, and that, of course, is inefficient. It hurts productivity and it hurts the bottom line. Breaking Banks is proud to introduce NetSuite by Oracle, the unified business management software platform that handles every aspect of your business in an easy-to-use cloud platform, giving you the visibility and control you need to grow. With NetSuite, you can save time, money, and unneeded headaches by managing sales, finance, accounting, orders, HR, all together instantly, right from the desktop, your web browser, or your phone. That's why NetSuite is the world's number one cloud business system today. And right now, NetSuite is offering valuable insights with a free guide. It's called The 7 Key Strategies to Grow Your Profile at netsuite.com/fintech. That's netsuite.com/fintech to download your free guide, 7 Key Strategies to Grow Your Profits. netsuite.com/fintech.
When it comes to business, you'll find the experts here. Voice America Business Network.
You're listening to Breaking Banks, featuring your host, Brett King. To reach the show today, please call 1-866-472-5790. That's 1-866-472-5790. Or join the conversation on Twitter by using the hashtag Breaking Banks. Now, back to the program.
You're back with Breaking Banks. We are live from New York today. If you want to catch up on some of our previous episodes, check out breakingbanks.com or Voice America, our channel on the business channel on Voice America, or AM 1160, Stitcher Radio. There's plenty of options. iTunes, download podcast. Before the break, we were talking with James Barrett. James is the author of a book called Our Final Invention, Artificial Intelligence and the End of the Human Era. Where are we at in terms of today, James, in terms of the sophistication of what we would call artificial intelligence? Would you say that Watson is the height of machine intelligence today?
Yes, Watson is really kind of a marvel. It's what IBM is calling a cognitive architecture. They're not really calling it a computer anymore, but it's a cognitive or thinking architecture, and it aggregates all these wonderful powers that you were speaking about with Chris. It does hypothesis generation. It does statistical reasoning. It scores its answers. It does all these things that our brains do. And so right now it's the and then we can already see how powerful it is and all the jobs it's starting to emulate. It's starting to plunge into. It's getting involved in medicine and diagnostics and getting involved in business analytics and insight. So yeah, it's a really powerful. It's the most powerful AI we've got right now. Although I think the Google Brain project is probably hot on its heels.
Yeah, there was one other that Elon Musk is involved in as well, and some of these guys, I can't remember, starts with V, right? What's that called?
It's interesting you wrote, you mentioned Elon Musk, DeepMind.
DeepMind, yeah.
DeepMind, Elon Musk came out and he tweeted about my book, actually, which was...
Yeah, well, that's how I found out about
terrific.
You.
Yeah,
that's how
great.
I found out about you and the book, so thanks, Elon.
Well, Elon Musk, having Elon Musk mention you is like having a little ticker tape parade on the internet. it did a boost for boost in sales for my book for that week. But Elon Musk came out and said, I invest in DeepMind and other AI companies not because I want to make money, but because I'm worried about superintelligence and I want to be aware of the state of the art. Yeah. And he came out and said that, and he's not just a futurist. He's bringing the future here. Yeah. But he follows in the footsteps of some other pretty impressive people. Stephen Hawking came out about a month ago and said, "I'm really concerned about super intelligence or advanced AI outsmarting us in the future." Yeah. He was joined by Max Tegmark and Stuart Russell, who's one of the premier AI programmers in the country. So,
but this is essentially inevitable. That we're getting, you know, at some point, machine intelligence is going to outstrip human intelligence, or all of the intelligence on the planet, conceptually. So, how do we make that transition?
Well, that's why I wrote my book. I want it to be a happy transition instead of a miserable one.
Yeah.
What we do is we have to, back to Elon Musk, and he invested in a company called DeepMind. DeepMind was sold to Google for $400 million, and they made a condition of their sale, DeepMind did. A condition of their sale is that Google set up a safety and ethics board for the use of their technology, because they recognize that that advanced AI is a dual-use technology, not unlike nuclear fission. It's capable of great good, great right. potential, and also great harm.
And Kurzweil's involved in that, I think, isn't he?
He's involved in Google, and he's the Thomas Edison of our time. He's such a great inventor, and he has long espoused reverse engineering the brain, really taking all the lessons of the brain and applying them into computers as the best way to achieve human level intelligence in a machine.
Right.
So he's involved with Google. Right now, there's kind of a race between Google and IBM to create human-level intelligence in a computer.
And what about some of these new startups like Vicarious Systems and others?
Yeah, well, Vicarious has the unique distinction of they were asking for investment money, and then they stopped asking because they had enough for the next like 10 or 15 years.
Wow.
I forget. It's an enviable place to be in. They're also on the cutting edge, and they are operating kind of undercover. They're not really revealing much about their technology.
Right. They've said it's the real deal.
Well, the real deal would be, what everyone's thinking it is, and that's the you mentioned the Turing test. People, why would anyone want to invent human level intelligence, at the price of a computer? Yeah. Well, because it would be an incredibly lucrative product. Imagine having your an IBM Watson Plus as your laptop. Imagine putting 10,000 of these, human-level computers, putting them together and doing cancer research and doing climate modeling and doing, weapons development. I mean, there would be a huge, huge market for that, and there's a giant intelligence race right now.
So we talked about, obviously there are going to be some jobs lost with this. I talk about in the banking space that things like compliance and risk officers disappear because these are decisions made in real time by algorithms. But and advisors, we talked about the impact of that with Chris. I think the best advice is advice that can be generated in real time. So I think humans just slow down that process of advice. There's definitely some jobs at risk. But what could be the new jobs that are created around this second machine age?
I wanted to add to that list. 73% of U.S. equity trade takes place by high frequency trading algorithms.
Right.
So most of the it operates at millisecond rates that our brains can't possibly keep up with. And that's
and it's interesting. I've seen some data. Or some reports on that the machine learning or the algorithms that do that high frequency trading have started to make trades that have been extremely successful, but would have been completely counterintuitive for a human.
Yeah, absolutely. There's a whole lot of biases that traders have. The traders have a problem of they don't stray away from initial judgment even when they've got conflicting evidence. They do things like that, but a machine will make its judgment and change it based on what information is available. And there's a whole list of reasoning issues that humans have that machines don't have. Mm. But at the same time, there were flash crashes on Wall Street where the Dow lost millions of dollars of value. One company, Knight Investment, went out of business because it lost too much value in a flash crash.
These flash crashes have been attributed to high frequency dark pool trading systems, right?
Yes, absolutely. Almost a year ago, the S&P lost $136 billion in 4 minutes because a high-frequency trading algorithm was, no kidding, reading the paper, reading the Twitter feeds. A tweet came from the White House that said there was a fire in the White House. The White House had Twitter account had been breached. It was fake, so it lost that value. But it came right back. It bounced right back. But yeah, that
I remember happens. That. I remember that. So what about the how should we be training our kids to not serve machine intelligence but work with them hand in hand? One of the things Chris mentioned was teaching machines to learn. But what are some of the other new jobs that you think will be created out of this?
I think anything you can do to get close to something that a technology that's going to sell a lot of. So, kids can no longer say, I don't get computers, because most of the jobs that will be left will be technology jobs. There won't be, saying I don't get computers will be an unaffordable luxury for everyone. Yeah. And I think women need to get into computing, because they've been generally left out of information technology, and they need to force their way in.
Well, women just took over as the number one demographic on gaming, so there's
that's right.
Good signs.
Well, I think there's probably a big future in gaming. So I bet gaming jobs will come in, but I'm not sure. I'm not an expert on the jobs that are going to be made by this. I'm more, I know that my job as a documentary filmmaker is probably on the line. Writers' jobs of all kinds are on the line. So don't get into anything a computer can do better, is my advice.
So, I liked your Arthur C. Clarke quote. He said, I think it's just a matter of time before machines dominate mankind and intelligence will win out. Mm-hmm. So, in terms of your gut feel for this, you talk about it being the final invention.
Yes.
What is going to be some of the short-term impacts to society, apart from job loss? What are some of the things where we're going to come up against this super intelligence that is
sure.
going to change the way we live?
I think in the short term, we're going to have a big debate about battlefield robots and autonomous drones. The 56 nations are developing battlefield robots, and the gold standard will be autonomous battlefield robots and drones that kill without a human in the loop. So I think that's a big ethical question we're going to confront coming up. I think we're going to only see the good side of a lot of these technologies for a while, but then we need to watch very closely when these machines become human level intelligent and beyond. There'll probably be a very short time between the time when we've got machines that can pass the Turing test and the time when machines are thousands or even millions of times more intelligent than we are. And I know that's kind of a science fiction idea, but it's really not that far away. As you said a minute ago, it's not really when it's going to happen. It's what happens next. Will we have been prepared for it?
So then the question of the emotion and ethics, which is it's something that's sort of this part of human consciousness that is probably the most difficult to program.
Yeah, that's really the challenge. If we create super intelligent machines that have no ethical base, then we'll basically have super intelligent sociopaths. If they have no reason to favor our interests, human interests, then they'll favor their own. And as I write in my book, there's a good reasons to believe that super intelligent machines won't be benign. They won't be no motivations. In fact, they'll have drives of their own, and they're outlined in the book. They won't be a tractor. They'll be an intelligent machine trying to seek its goals and using whatever resources they can to do it. So we have a window now to prepare for that, to do things like Elon Musk is saying, to start ethics and safety boards, to have people who are developing advanced AI come forward and talk about the ethics behind their inventions.
Great. So listen, we're going to wrap up, James, but tell the audience where they can get your book and find out more about this story.
Sure. My book is called Our Final Invention. It's available on Amazon. It's available at Barnes & Noble. You can go to my website, jamesbarrett.com, B-A-R-R-A-T, and find links to it there. And it's coming on paperback in next year. It's on Kindle. You can listen to it on audible.com.
and it was voted as one of the Huffington Post definitive tech books of 2013 as well.
Yeah, it it came out about a year ago, got a very good reception. It continues to draw interest because I think people really have a feeling that, you know, that it's not. There's a lot of good news.
We're going to wrap up, James. But thanks very much for being on the show, James Barrett, the author of Our Final Invention. We'll be back next week. We'll be talking about a digital identity, very fitting with the new iPhone and iWallet coming out. Thanks for joining us again. It's been a great show.
Thanks, Brett. Thank you very much.
And we'll have you on again, hopefully, James. You've been listening to Breaking Banks. We'll talk to you guys again next week.
You've been listening to Breaking Banks with host Brett King. Please be sure to join us again next Thursday at noon Pacific Time, 3 p.m. Eastern Time, for more of the latest in fintech news.